Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Stacey Hurt, a patient consultant and disabilities advocate and a national keynote speaker. And I think this will end up being the first of a series, but Stacey and I are also inaugural members of the new HIMSS Digital Influencer Program. So Stacey, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Matt. I'm super excited.
It's great to have you on. And what I always like to do before really diving into our main topics is to let my guests provide a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So Stacey, the floor is yours.
Well, again, thank you and congratulations to you as a fellow digital influencer this year at HIMSS 2020. I feel like when I talk about my background, I feel like I have sort of three separate stories that have culminated into the work that I do now. And so my first life, if you would, was I worked in physician practice management, marketing, operations, sales, training, a lot of different healthcare management backgrounds for several years. And I have one of my master's degrees is in health administration. So that was sort of all the work that I did was working with physicians and healthcare professionals in a variety of settings on the business and delivery side. And, you know, I was kind of tracking along that career very nicely until 2003. Our first son was born, Griffin. He's 16 now. But in 2005, our son Emmett was born. And Emmett was diagnosed with a very rare chromosomal abnormality. In fact, so rare, he is one of three known cases in the world. This diagnosis affects him to this day where he cannot walk, talk, care for himself in any way. He needs lifted. He's non-ambulatory. He doesn't sign. He's basically a 14-year-old baby, and he depends on my husband and me for all of his needs. And Emmett's diagnosis dramatically affected me in the way that I viewed the world, my work, really changed me as a person. And while I was sort of juggling Emmett's needs and our older son's needs, I retired from pharmaceutical sales in 2008 to attend to all those needs. I reemerged back into the pharmaceutical industry as head of training and development a couple years later. And just when things were going well for that, I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in 2014. On my 44th birthday. I've been an athlete my whole life. I live a healthy lifestyle. I'm a non-smoker. And it was the last thing that anybody ever expected. I had no family history and no risk factors. And obviously under the age of 50 at age 44, also very rare. And so this turned our world upside down. I had 27 tumors in my body, in my rectum, liver, lungs, and lymph nodes. And I was given, in fact, a less than 10% chance of surviving. So we are caring for our disabled son. We're caring for our other son. And now I'm fighting for my life. And again, dramatically influenced my view on the world. And I worked for a while, but I had to leave it up until my surgery in April of 2015. I was deemed resectable. And, you know, they went in and I had a dramatic response to chemotherapy. Unprecedented was a word that they used. And I did some maintenance chemotherapy afterwards. I did 55 chemos in total. I had CyberKnife radiation, two surgeries. And at speaking to you, I am cancer free. And I'm grateful. It's a total miracle. And so all of this through my healthcare experience, my experience with our disabled son and my cancer journey, it's culminated into now my my emerging career of being a patient consultant and really being the voice of the patient in healthcare delivery, design, innovation, and representing patients who can't stand up or speak for themselves due to cancer, due to disabilities, whatever it is affecting them. But, you know, working again in business, and you know, not just quote unquote telling my story, but utilizing all of my experience to provide a patient perspective in innovations and creation. So that's me to date.
And that description, you know, obviously understanding it was a very, you know, probably high level description and you know, probably quickly move through your experience. You know, what did you learn from your personal care journey that helped inform why you want to get your, why you're moving into the area of being a patient consultant and, mm-hmm. And a patient advocate?
Yeah, you know, I was very fortunate that I had, you know, all that healthcare experience because I worked side by side with, especially in physician practice management, I worked side by side talking about things like, you know, coding and their compensation. And, you know, I posted charges. I did check-in, check-out. I actually worked in the office and alongside physicians. So I was never, you know, intimidated by, you know, I didn't have any white coat syndrome. I just knew physicians and other healthcare professionals as colleagues and people that, you know, I was working with. So when it came to me being on the side of, you know, a caregiver for our son, and then in which being a caregiver for M, it greatly prepared me for my fight against cancer. And, you know, I wasn't intimidated to ask really tough questions about his diagnosis, about my diagnosis. And, you know, what I found in my work is, unfortunately, people don't know what they don't know. And so many times when we were caring for Emmett, our special son, you know, my husband and I, who are, you know, intelligent professionals, we would say, we don't know what's going on. And we have, you know, all this education and experience. What is everybody else doing? You know, they don't know what they don't know. They don't know how to advocate for themselves. They're intimidated to ask these tough questions. And then so that, again, as you said, that fueled me to help those people and empower those people and give them more support. We have, in total, though, we do have such a different patient now than we had, you know, pre-internet 25 years ago. We have a much more savvy, informed patient that, fortunately or unfortunately, the first place they're going is to the internet, to Dr. Google, to diagnose, you know, their condition. And so we're more, you know, looking at patients as partners in care. It's not so adversarial as it used to be, you know, 25, 30 years ago. Now it's, I have this information, you have this information, how can we work together to make informed decisions? So, like I said, I was very lucky that, you know, I knew what to ask for the most part. I knew what to say, and I wasn't afraid to say it to healthcare professionals, but there's so many other people that aren't. And I'm just hoping that my experience can help them.
So kind of what aspects of having been within the system did you find most helpful? And then also at the same time, you know, the converse, you know, what challenges still existed for you? Because, you know, I think even though, as you're saying, you are very familiar and you're used to working side by side with the professionals, it still seems once you transition from the professional colleague to the patient mm-hmm. side of things, the perception will change, and even the way that you get interacted with, even if you're still interacting with people you might have known professionally.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's this old adage, and certainly, you know, present company included here, I think they say that doctors and attorneys are the worst patients because we are our own worst enemies because of what we know. So, you know, where I became frustrated was, you know, for sort of the lack of continuum of care. Each time with our son, with my cancer, you know, every time I had to repeat my story, you know, I found myself a couple times, you know, saying, because you go into the room and first you have to see the fellow, first you see a resident, then you see a fellow, then you see the physician. And if they started asking me the same questions, I would say, you should know this, read the chart, you know, do your homework. And so in that sense, I think that I came to expect more at times, you know, that I was getting, and I became a bit frustrated because, you know, of what I knew. So that that might have been a little bit rough. But, you know, really what helped were obviously, you know, like I said, the internet is such a double-edged sword, because if you do know how to use it, you know, it can be so beneficial, and you kind of deem from it the information, but you can go way too far deep in the weeds to where, you know, now I counsel a bunch of patients individually. Patients reach out to me from all over the country to ask for advice about, you know, colon cancer, cancer, et cetera. And, you know, I tell them, stay off the internet, stay off the internet. Just stay in your fight, stay in your lane. Okay, tune out these negative distractions, and just everybody's fight is different. You stay in yours. So, you know, it was easier for me to do that. It's not, I think, so easy for your average patient to do that.
You know, it's very interesting to hear you say that, you know, the internet is both a boon and a harm. And I think it's a really good point. You know, having all the information readily available is very helpful. But, you know, as you're suggesting, at the same time, it can be difficult to sort through it, because yeah. Something can come off as really authoritative on the internet, but be completely off base because there's no support for it. So, it seems like you're suggesting, you know, it can be helpful to look, but mm-hmm. also keep an open mind and use that to establish a really good open dialogue with your care team.
Absolutely. I will be the first, you know, as much healthcare experience as I have, I'm the first to tell you I'm not a doctor. I didn't go to med school. I give doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs, all of my utmost respect. Okay. They have the clinical knowledge. They are the boss. Your doctor is the boss, and absolutely, you can go with, you know, you can do your own research, and I tell everybody, be your own informed advocate, but ultimately take that information and present that, as you said, Matt, to your physician, to your healthcare provider, and say, this is what I found. What do you think of this? What do you think? I read about this clinical trial. What do you think about this? Ultimately, your healthcare professional, your physician is the boss, and I always tell people that, you know, that's why you have them, you know. And if you don't love your oncologist, you need to find a new one, because you absolutely, that person, for my oncologist, I mean, he is my biggest fan. I'm his biggest fan. He's my biggest cheerleader. He has fueled me so much mentally, emotionally, physically, to fight this thing back and fight it and beat it into the ground. And I trust him implicitly. I trust his decision making. He is so intelligent. He's up on all the latest data, and he's always led me right.
Yeah, no, and I think having that good working relationship and the, you know, the kind of that positive back and forth as you just described is really important, because if you dread going into the physician's office, or you have that kind of negative connotation around it, I'd imagine that's going to kind of influence what happens with the care, because, you know, while yes, you know, drug treatments or other services play a role, so, you know, I think there's also that psychological factor of, if you believe something is going to help, then, you know, that helps with your body as well.
Yes, I'm a big proponent. One of the big sort of pillars of my healing, if you would, has been a field called integrative oncology. I really want to be careful when I talk about integrative oncology. It is not holistic. It is not alternative. It is what they call integrative oncology. So it is putting science and research first, and conventional chemotherapy, radiation, surgery first and foremost. And then it's using modalities such as yoga, Reiki, meditation, massage, to offset side effects, increase stamina, increase physical, emotional, mental well-being. And I'm a big proponent of mind, body, spirit healing. Again, with, you know, as I said, conventional treatments being first and foremost, but then drawing on these other things to increase your overall stamina. It was a big part of my healing. And back to an earlier point you said, I just believe collaboration is such a key word for me. Collaboration with your team, collaboration with your support system, your caregivers, your friends, and collaboration within yourself and being at your absolute best to fight this disease.
Yes, no, I think you're right. Collaboration is definitely a key. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Stacey Hurt, and we've been talking about patient advocacy and understanding, you know, kind of how a care journey works. And Stacey, kind of a point that I'd like to get to now, which is, you know, ties into what you said earlier, which is the fact that, you know, at this point, you're more, you know, you had your treatment, and it's, you know, you're, I can't remember if you said it or not, but you're kind of in the survivor role at this point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems like that would be a natural extension and maybe an ongoing extension of the initial treatment. But it feels like survivorship isn't really a topic that's discussed, or at least discussed in the open.
Well, Matt, this is certainly one of my passion projects. And, you know, I'm just going to speak very frankly about survivorship. Why it's such a neglected field is because, you know, and again, I can say this because I worked with doctors in the revenue cycle. You know, there's nothing to cut. There's nothing to treat. There's nothing that's going to generate revenue in a traditional fee-for-service sense. So if you're not doing any of those things, if you're a health system, how are you going to make money? And this is the challenge that is confronting us because there's going to be, I believe, 18 million cancer survivors by the year 2030, okay? So what are we doing to support these things? I can tell you firsthand, I'm not better. I mean, I'm out of treatment and I'm surviving. I'm not back to normal. I'm not fine. I suffer first and foremost with a condition called lower anterior resection syndrome, LARS, where I have from colon cancer, and I'm not afraid to talk about this, that I have to be in close proximity to a bathroom based on foods that I eat or you know, different things that I ingest that will flare what's left of my rectum and colon to where I have to be in the bathroom. Okay, so that's a necessary accommodation for me in the workplace and the work that I do. So that's just one example of a myriad of conditions that these survivors are faced with that they shouldn't be punished for in the workplace, and they shouldn't feel bad or that it's a stigma to talk about. They're trying to get back to their sense of normal, their career, what, you know, defined and enriched their identity. They shouldn't be punished for accommodations that they need for their ongoing survivorship. But, you know, so what are we doing to further that conversation, you know, and what are healthcare systems doing? I just set up an appointment with my integrative oncologist later this month because I had the stomach bug. I was throwing up and broke a rib. Now, here I am working out every day, doing everything I'm supposed to do. But because cancer and treatments have weakened my bones, I need to get a DEXA scan at age 49 and get on, you know, a bisphosphonate for my bones. Who knew that? Did anybody tell me that as a survivor? No, didn't know that. So a lot of us are out there blazing our own trail, and we need more support.
And in terms of kind of creating that support, you know, how does it change the composition of the professionals that you're working with? You know, I know you just referenced that you're still seeing your integrative oncologist. Mm-hmm. You know, so is that physician still your focal point, or has it shifted to a PCP, or kind of what does that interaction look like?
Well, Matt, you bring up an excellent point, and one that's a big topic of conversation in the support groups and in the community. Who owns us as survivors? You know, who is navigating our care? Because my PCP right now, I mean, she told me, she said, you know, your oncologist is taking over now. You know, he's the navigator of your care. And then I go see my oncologist, and he says, well, wait, are you following up with your PCP to get things checked, such as your thyroid, your cholesterol, you know, your regular, you know, when do you resume your quote unquote regular, you know, your mammogram, OB-GYN? So So we don't know as survivors. We're kind of out in this limbo of who owns us and who navigates our care. It's a good question. We don't know. And I think that, and that's, and just to highlight another point is that, you know, a lot of people are uncomfortable when talking about long-term cancer survivors because you're either, and again, pardon this, but you're either dying or you're fine. You know, are you okay? Are you fine? Well, you know, I have so many friends right now, they're survivors from day one, but they're still in treatment. So I'm trying to coin this new saying, survivors in treatment. They're far from fine. They're still fighting, you know, but they're out there surviving and trying to have a life. And so I wish I could answer your question, but it's all to be determined.
Yeah, and kind of having an ongoing, you know, evolutionary discussion around the process seems like it aligns with some of the overall discussions that are happening in healthcare with, you know, kind of call it the transition to value-based care, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, moving away from a thought process of we're concerned about a particular episode and we're going to, you know, we're basically treating a particular issue as it arises and moving the focus to, you know, whole health and preventive mm-hmm. care and thinking about care along a continuum, which seems like it, as I said, aligns with the process that you're describing.
Well, it certainly makes a lot of sense, but, you know, you think about if you're an insurance company and you think about portability of career and you think about, you know, if you're an insurance company, if you're my patient today, you might not be my patient tomorrow. So what's in it for me to keep you healthy? You know, if you're just going to leave to go to another insurance company, then there's no skin in the game for me to keep you healthy. And so that's a problem. And that's where a gap exists. And that's where we need to really come together and figure this out. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, data sharing and things like that. It definitely, if you look at the whole health system, you know, as a country, however you want to say it, of course, it makes a ton of sense for us to put more into preventive care. And then on the other side of it, survivorship and ongoing preventative care, just to keep us healthy as a society, we're going to drive down healthcare costs. But how do we get each player in the game, each stakeholder, to understand that larger view and that larger cost savings? Again, I don't know. These are some of the discussions that we need to keep having.
And I would also see it, you know, beyond getting each side to think about, you know, how do we get the skin in the game and why do we want to be invested in it? It's also mm-hmm. getting all those different players talking with each other, because mm-hmm. I think siloed discussions are just going to drive a continued existence of a fragmented system, because each side will come up with what it views as the best solution without thinking about how it impacts all the other stakeholders.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And it's really getting each person, when we talk about sort of this, you know, healthcare crisis and the different players in the game, if you want to talk about, you know, the government, you want to talk about the payers as the insurance company, you want to talk about the providers, you want to talk about the patients. You know, really, we have to get everybody together and everybody has to give up a little bit. We all have to make a little bit of a compromise to come together and solve this problem. It's not just the government's problem. It's not just the insurance companies. It's not just, you know, so everybody just has to give a little. And like you said, we have to keep these lines of communication open to understand really what's in it for each player. And maybe that sounds naive and maybe that sounds idealistic, but I really believe that's the only way we're going to get it done.
Yeah, and I don't think it sounds naive, but I do think that it's the constant challenge, because it's, you know, how do you get everyone to the position of being willing to compromise? Because it's, you know, mm-hmm. while a compromise might allow you to benefit more in the long run, mm-hmm. It can be difficult to have that focus shift from the immediate return to mm-hmm. the future.
Well, and certainly that's a challenge across every industry. It's, you know, how do we go from acute short-sightedness, you know, to the larger, more global, long-term view. It's a challenge across every industry, it's nothing new, but particularly in healthcare. I found this again, speaking frankly, you know, nobody understands it until it affects them. You know, we can talk about it and we can, you know, we can draft models and we can propose things, but until it happens to you, until you are, you know, in my case, told you have cancer, and I had great insurance, I had fantastic insurance, and I still, you know, had to write out checks for very large deductibles, you know, $6,000. And this is me, you know, I am very fortunate, and I'm very informed. What is everybody else doing, which is a whole nother discussion about barriers to care and healthcare disparities and underserved populations? You know, what are those people doing and how are they getting to the care that they need? And that those are the people that reach out to me every day. And I'm getting another discussion here, but, you know, that's the patient who contacts me in, you know, deep in Mississippi, and she's nowhere near an NCI cancer center. And she's telling me how she's been cared for. And it's totally against any protocol that I've ever read or seen. And she can't just get up and drive to an NCI cancer center. But how do we get her that second opinion that she needs, you know, to get to healing, to get to recovery? And you know, we talk about telemedicine and we talk about, you know, now we have, you know, imaging that a radiologist can read off of his iPad sitting on a beach in Hawaii, and we can transmit those. But then how do we protect that patient's privacy? You know, again, all ongoing discussions that each player in the game has to talk about the implications.
No, and I agree. There are a lot of challenges there and a lot of uncertainty. And believe it or not, we're already very close to the end of our time. So I'd like to, you know, kind of allow one final question to build off of what you just said, which would be, you know, ideally, what change would you like to see occur in healthcare in the coming year?
Target, if you are listening, I have an awesome idea that will revolutionize care for patients. I just checked last night if it exists, and it doesn't. It is my dream to bring this to market. So I have a great idea. I would love to make that a reality in 2020. It's a personal goal. But I think one realistic change, and I haven't touched on this, but I really want to see patients be more involved in decision-making in industry. And, you know, again, I've been lucky to be a part of a couple of these discussions as a patient consultant, but I want to see more patients utilized to be part of early on in drug development, in technology development, because we are the end user. And it's not, oh, poor Stacy, she had cancer. Oh, no. Stacy had 20 years healthcare experience that she can bring to the table and help you develop a very effective product and make you think of things probably you never thought of. And I'm just not Stacy. There's a million other Stacys out there that want their voice heard in the development of these emerging products. And so I really, in this upcoming year, I want to hear more patient voices, like I said, in industry, in development, in technology.
No, and I think that is definitely an achievable goal and a very good thought to part on, because unfortunately, as I said, believe it or not, we are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Stacy Hurt, for a great conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt, and have a great day.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.